Merci. Chers collègues, c'est un grand plaisir pour moi d'avoir l'occasion de partager mon travail sur le chartisme avec vous. Ne vous inquiétez pas, je ne vais pas continuer en français. Malheureusement, malgré les efforts courageux de mes professeurs au collège pendant 5 longues années, mon niveau en français est resté faible. Parlez beaucoup, mais jamais en français. Je n'ose pas vous adresser en français aujourd'hui. Je me sens extrêmement gêné et je vous prie mais d'excuser. I'm deeply honored that my book Chartism, A New History has been published in a French translation, and I thank you all for being here this afternoon to share the moment, especially Jean-Paul Caron, Quentin Delimeau, and Dominique Kaifer, for the presentations that they will be making. I'm tremendously grateful to Publication de l'Université Sorbonne for its support, and I'm grateful too to Professor Laurent Biry for providing the most sensitive and perceptive of translations. I really am in his debt. Laurent undertook this task with great care, and I learned a great deal from our email exchanges. My greatest debt, however, is to my friend Professor Fabrice Bensimon, without whose time, energy, and enthusiasm this edition would have been no more than a dream, and I thank you most sincerely, Fabrice. A few words by way of introduction. It is a great pleasure to me that a book that I wrote in 2007 now appears in French. It is exactly 100 years since Édouard Dollien published his book, also called Le Chartisme. Dollien's was the first modern history to be written of this remarkable history, of this remarkable movement. It was only after the Great War that the first English language histories of Chartism appeared by historians, as opposed to, in the case of one participant of the movement. That the pioneering historian of Chartism should have been French reflected the importance of France to the Chartists themselves. Even before the events of 1848, France was an almost constant point of reference in Chartist journalism and political discourse. A simple digital search of the online Northern Star, the greatest Chartist newspaper, shows that the Chartists referred more often to France than to any other nation, even the United States of America. When the People's Charter was first published 175 years ago this month, it was launched at a series of mass meetings across Britain. And in London, where the Working Men's Association had been responsible for first drawing up the People's Charter, a mass meeting was held outside the Houses of Parliament. On the platform that day was Monsieur Coulier of Paris. Alongside him was the veteran English radical Arthur Wade, who'd been a leader of the campaign for a free pardon for the Tolpuddle Martyrs, 6 agricultural labourers from Dorset in the west of England who had been transported to Australia in 1834 for setting up a trade union. Wade himself had just returned from Paris, not quite sure with what purpose, but together Wade and Monsieur Coulier presented to this meeting outside the Houses of Parliament fraternal greetings from the workers of France, and I quote, in the great struggle for democracy and independence. France was symbolically present, therefore, almost at the birth of Chartism. Now, it's true to say that within the Chartist movement, internationalism was always much more obvious in London than it was elsewhere. And I'm not claiming that there was a consistently significant internationalist perspective in Chartism. But I suggest that it was greater than we think, and it wasn't limited to the much cited example of the Fraternal Democrats, founded in the mid-1840s and based principally in London, with one or two nodes of activity in the industrial north. As I've said, this is the 175th anniversary to the month of the launch of the People's Charter, and the anniversary is being, I think it would be best to say, modestly celebrated in Britain. But it is being celebrated where it matters most, in the Houses of Parliament. More MPs, more members of the British House of Commons, have signed a resolution greeting this anniversary than ever signed than ever voted or supported Chartism's demands at the time. And for the first time, there is to be a small exhibition in the Houses of Parliament, along with a small programme of events at Westminster, to commemorate and acclaim, and here I quote from the House of Commons resolution, that the People's Charter was a blueprint for our parliamentary democracy, and saluting the men and women of the Chartist movement across the United Kingdom who sacrificed so much. In addition to these happenings in Westminster, in a few weeks there'll be the latest of an annual series of colloquia devoted to Chartism, at which Fabrice will be one of the speakers. But actually, I calculate that this afternoon and this publication are the very first of the anniversary year to be devoted to the movement. Now, I'd like to go on to say a little bit more about the book and my approach to it, for as Fabrice Bensimon says in his generous preface to this new French edition, it is not a theoretical work. So first, I want to say something about my choice of narrative as the vehicle for the book. And secondly, I want briefly to consider Chartism in relation to class and to the languages by which class is understood. So the choice of narrative first. Of course, I know it's a fallacy that it could be possible to portray history as it actually happened. However, I wanted my history of Chartism to unfold as far as possible without abusing the privilege of hindsight. I also hoped that readers would reach their own conclusions concerning the character of the movement without feeling either alienated by long passages of introduction, historiographical surveys, or theoretical abstraction, or dragooned by me into accepting a particular interpretation. My reasons for wanting to do this were first that a substantial narrative history of Chartism, covering the whole of its 20-year period, was long overdue, and I hoped to supply this gap with a volume that was grounded in an intensive reading of contemporary sources, as well as one that drew extensively on the subject's huge secondary literature. I tried to write a book that was alive to the experiences and achievements of those who had called themselves Chartists. The historiography of Chartism has become atomised, theorised and distilled to the point where I think it had become difficult to understand how it felt to be a Chartist, or to oppose the movement, or simply just to witness it, assuming that a neutral stance was possible during the period of Chartism's greatness, which I rather doubt. One of the things that I felt the historiography of Chartism also lacked was any work which captured its drama or evoked its passions, and that therefore conveyed the full extent of the challenge Chartism posed to the political status quo. And here I think the narrative form is essential, combining as only it can both an attention to chronology and an appreciation of the role of chance and contingency and the sheer complexity of events, in which the Chartist leadership, to put it bluntly, not infrequently floundered. I realise that this opens me to the charge of avoiding the analytical complexity needed to make sense of a period of profound disturbance and upheaval. Many historians, though perhaps less in Britain than was once the case, subscribe to the view that analytical complexity means that narrative is very unlikely to be the best vehicle for historical explanation. The flow of narrative can all too easily imply that event A caused event B because chronologically B came after A. Yet more problematically, the narrative form would seem incapable of conveying, still less analysing, the deep structural factors predisposing Britain to widespread social unrest in the 1830s and 1840s, and, no less crucially, explaining the deep structural factors predisposing Britain to continued stability. But I chose thickened narrative, to borrow the term from Clifford Geertz, the anthropologist. The best I think that I can say is that I chose narrative consciously or reflectively. I do not believe that it is scholarship or even ideology that primarily determines the character of a historical work, but the aesthetic choices of the author, which inform the discursive strategies of the text and therefore the strategies of understanding and construing the meaning of the historical events that the text strives to depict. Choosing narrative as my discursive strategy was also a political and a moral choice, as well as an aesthetic one. Here you can glimpse, I think, my roots as an educational practitioner in adult education. For the first two-thirds of my career, I never taught an undergraduate or supervised a postgraduate history student. I worked for the University of Leeds, but in a special dedicated department off-campus teaching adult students on courses that they took of their own free will, paying their fees, turning up in the back rooms of pubs, memorably on a few occasions, church halls, primary school classrooms, the length and breadth of Yorkshire. And to some extent, that has always been that constituency of adult students studying outside of any formal curriculum, most of whom had had no previous engagement in university. That constituency remains my assumed audience. It also reflects, I think, my intellectual